This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
We're here today to celebrate the launch of recent writings by Walter Benjamin, which New Documents, which is a publishing house based in Vancouver and Los Angeles, has put out. Jeff Ronsari, the publisher, unfortunately can't be with us tonight. And the recent writings, there's a sample of it on one of the essays from the book, I believe, is on eFlux's website. Is that correct?
Yes.
So if you're interested in seeing a sample of the book in advance, you can go to the eFlux site and see it there. You all know Walter Benjamin as a philosopher and art theoretician, writer of a very famous essay in 1936, The Work of Art, The Age of Mechanical Reproduction. And in 1986, many years after he died at the Franco-Spanish border, he started to reappear, originally with a lecture called Mondrian 6396, which was organized by the Marxist Center in Ljubljana. And in recent years, he's been writing more and more extensively about art and history. And many of his interviews and essays have been talking about the Museum of American Art in Berlin. And the Museum of American Art is a Berlin-based educational institution, this is the mission statement, dedicated to assembling, preserving, and exhibiting memories of modern American art shown in Europe in the mid-20th century. We are very pleased to have with us tonight for the launch of the book a technical assistant from the museum who's flown over from Berlin to guide us through the museum's history and its collection. And so please welcome the technical assistant.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. First, I would like to ask if anyone has a comment on or a question regarding this mission statement here. Okay. We'll begin with this logo of the Museum of American Art, and I guess many of you would recognize that it comes out of this logo of the International Exhibition of Modern Art that took place in New York 1913, known as the Armory Show, and this was a 100 years anniversary just happened to be this year. So that's the origin of the logo. The International Exhibition of Modern Art took place in New York, 1913. These are some of the views of the exhibition. Why was this exhibition interesting? We all know that this was a very important exhibition for the development of the American art scene, and consequently it has effects on European art scene as well. This was, as we can see from this catalog of the International Exhibition of Modern Art, perhaps the first exhibition in which artists were grouped together regardless of their nationalities. As you can see on these two pages of the catalog, we will find Braque, Kirchner, Kandinsky, Cezanne, Hartley, Duchamp. This was completely unusual at that time, since the International Exhibition of Modern Art or Contemporary Art began in 1855 in Paris with a Exposition Universelle, where at the Palace de Beaux-Arts was presented contemporary art. It was an international exhibition, but it was organized by national pavilions. As you can see here, each nation has its own section or a pavilion. Throughout 19th century, all the subsequent exhibition of international exhibition of contemporary art were organized by national pavilions. The idea of national pavilions derives from the notion of national schools that was introduced at early of the late 18th century, beginning of 19th century, with the establishment of the museums, when the museums began structured chronologically and by national schools. So that was how the past was structured, and in this case now we have a process of structuring the present through the notion of national schools and national pavilions. And this was, in fact, standardized with the emergence of the Venice Biennale almost 40 years after this exhibition, where we have regular biannual exhibitions of contemporary art arranged by national pavilions, even until today. So this was the Armory Show was a big change in that respect and marks some of the important characteristics of the 20th century art scene and what was happening primarily in the United States, not in Europe. So this is the logo of the Museum of American Art in Berlin. As you can see, it's located on Stalin Allee. Stalin Allee today has a different name, but since the exhibits of the Museum of American Art relates to the 50s, when this was a Stalin Allee, we in all our publications keep this address as the museum address. So it is located, so you have to enter to this passage, and the museum is located in the backyard building and has a few exhibits. Like this would be a room named after Dorothy Miller. It's the Dorothy Miller Gallery. It's the New American Painting, and this is a another room is called the Museum of Modern Art and Americans. Museum of Modern Art being this cube here, I mean this structure here, and the Americans are around. The structure of the Museum of Modern Art, which is 2 by 2 meters in this case, came out of this exhibition, Cubism and Abstract Art, that took place in 1936 at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Until this point, Museum of Modern Art was more or less a Kunsthalle. It was not really a museum. It didn't have its own space. It had 6 rooms. I think by this time they were already in a townhouse by 1936, and they didn't have their own collection. So for many years. So they were practically having operating as a Kunsthalle, not as a museum. And there was also a question, what is the meaning of the Museum of Modern Art? What will be the Museum of Modern Art? Because that was also something that was not well understood back then, perhaps even not today. So Alfred, until this point, there was the idea of torpedo in time. Maybe some of you are familiar with this notion that Alfred Barr came up with, that there will be the Museum of Modern Art will be kind of a temporary place to keep works of contemporary art that will then, after 50 years, be transferred to the Metropolitan Museum. That concept was clearly abandoned with this diagram, which was historization of the last 3 decades of the 20th century modern art. And as you could see on here, there is this diagram is based on movements and international movements, not national schools. That was also a big change in understanding or interpreting the modern art. Although all these movements that were included here appeared within a context of national schools, this was a retroactive change of the context, basically, what Alfred Barr did. So the idea of internationalism and the movements in 20th century modern art appeared with some movements like Dada. Dada was very international as a movement. However, it was not historicized. It was not turned into kind of a museum narrative or concept of making a museum. This is what we see now is a proposal how the 20th century museum modern art should look like. So as you can see, it starts with the post-impressionist at the MoMA collection. It was materialized later from Cézanne, the bather. You know, it starts with the bather, and you can go in two directions, to Matisse and Fauves and to non-geometrical abstraction, and from Cézanne also to Cubism, Suprematism, Constructivism, and Bauhaus and Steele, and to geometrical abstract art. So that was this diagram became later a blueprint from the MoMA permanent display. Now MoMA knew what the Museum of Modern Art is going to look like. One interesting thing about this, in addition to having international movements, is that on this diagram there are no Americans. And you have a Museum of Modern Art in New York has no Americans in a major story, in a canon. You would not imagine anything similar in any country of Europe. Only here. The second thing is that many Americans who came to the MoMA and saw this exhibition thought this is how Europeans see themselves, but that was not true. This is not how Europeans interpreted themselves. It was the American interpretation of European modern art. And the third, the Americans who came to see the show, especially artists, were asking where we are going to be in this story. Where is our place? That was the question. On the other hand, it was these American artists who had a chance to see first this new paradigm and build on it. And this is one of the key explanations why we have the emergence of the American art after the Second World War. Europeans had no idea about the story until late after the Second World War. So that is about this exhibition. It was curated by Alfred Barr, who was a founding director of the Museum of Modern Art. He was 26 years old when he became a director. And this is where the exhibition took place, in this townhouse. The exhibition was structured by not only painting, a sculpture, and prints, but also has a construction, photography, architecture, many other departments. One also interesting thing about this exhibition is that for this exhibition was one on which Demoiselles d'Avignon, the icon of the early 20th century modern art, was introduced to the public. And it was placed at the beginning of the story. It is because of this exhibition that this painting became what we know it as an icon. And when we open the books on modern art today, we find it at the beginning of the story. It is because it was introduced at this exhibition at the beginning of the story. But as you could see, it says here that it's not on the exhibition. So what was at the exhibition? This was at the exhibition. It was a print. So Museum of Modern Art, instead of exhibiting an original, they were exhibiting a reproduction. But obviously the narrative, the story, was for Alfred Barr more important than the actual artifact. So Alfred Barr was determined to put this painting at the beginning of the story, whatever it takes. So he couldn't get the original, he placed this reproduction. Another interesting feature is Destiny of Malevich, who by that time was completely removed from the Soviet museums. I'll mention it a bit later about this, something. But these were smuggled from, the works that you see here were smuggled from the Hanover Museum when they were left after the Malevich 1927 exhibition in Berlin. And it is thanks to this exhibition that we know about Malevich, because Alfred Barr had put it in this story here. The paintings came This, as you can see, these two paintings came from, first were exhibited in this exhibition here, which is 1915, the last Futurist exhibition many of you are familiar with. And then it traveled to Berlin. This is from, we see them here and here. At Große Berliner Kunstausstellung, 1927. And then in 1936, they were exhibited at MoMA. At the After Berlin show, Malevich works were transferred to the Landesmuseum in Hanover in the custody of Alexander Dorner. But in 1935, after 1933, it was very difficult to keep these paintings even in the storage. So they were then taken by an architect, Hugo Kering, who kept them in Berlin until 1943. And then, so the Malevich works were in Berlin until 1943, and then took them in the village and the countryside after the raids started over Berlin when the Allies arrived. So Bahr goes 1935 to Europe, goes to Hanover, meets Dorner, and takes six paintings and some drawings to New York for this exhibition. Since then, Malevich was on a permanent display only in the Museum of Modern Art until today. No other place. From 1935. The first Malevich that came from the other collection anywhere in the world was in 1957 from the Stedelijk collection, because the Stedelijk at that time acquired from the same stock the rest of the paintings that were left in Berlin. Until 57, the all Malevich that we have seen were from the MoMA. And also in the catalog we have the Tatlin's Monument to the Third International reproduced, and the Rodchenko. And this was all happening after already in the Soviet Union, avant-garde art was removed from the museum after a series of exhibitions that had disparaging, in a way, attitude toward the modern art that was considered to be bourgeois. And you can see here on the upper banner, it says, "The Dead End of Bourgeois Art." And here it says formalism, and formalism was the key term for disqualifying anything that was not socialistic realism, and self-denial. And we see Rodchenko, Malevich, two Malevich, and Kandinsky. So at the time when MoMA was exhibiting Malevich and the Rodchenko and other artists from the Soviet avant-garde, they could not be seen anywhere else in Europe, even in Germany, because by 1936 there were no modern art to be seen in the museums in Germany. Another important phenomenon, which was the Lisitsky's abstract cabinet, for which, as you can see, I don't want to get into description of the cabinet, but cabinet was exhibited in the same museum in Hanover from 1928 until 1936. And at 1936, it was being dismantled as this exhibition in New York was taking place. So the only place where it was remembered was at MoMA. And this was the recollection of Bahr regarding this exhibit. It was a cooperation between L. Lisitsky and Alexander Dorner. So it was Lisitsky's room of how to exhibit abstract art. And the works were from the museum taken to the and exhibited, confiscated and exhibited at the Entartete Kunst. And we see here Mondrian from the abstract cabinet being exhibited at the exhibition Munich Entartete Kunst. The prizes here are given to show to the public how much these stupid directors are paying for this garbage, basically. That was the idea, to discredit the museum directors. They're wasting public money. So this was the situation in Europe, and at the time in Paris we had what is known as a school of Paris. The modern art, what we know as abstract art or cubism, was completely forgotten. Interesting footnote here. Mondrian, who lived and worked in Paris from 1938, 20 years, and produced his neoplastic paintings in Paris, was introduced or included at the first Société Anonyme exhibition in 1926 in New York, and then at the Museum of Modern Art 1936. And it was part of the collection of both, part of the both collections. I would ask you to guess, when was Mondrian included in any French museum collection? What would you guess? And Mondrian was 20 years living and working in Paris, produced his neoplastic paintings. What would be your guess? Anyone has an idea? I was wrong. Just to tell you, I was completely wrong with my guess. So don't. I would say even earlier, like mid 50s, but that's not the case. It's 1978 at the Beaubourg. That was for the first time when Mondrian was introduced in any, became part of any public collection. And so it shows how strangely School of Paris was really conservative, and it will be explained later through this story why was this possible. Why, when you see the books on School of Paris, there is never Mondrian mentioned in the School of Paris, and he lived and worked there for 20 years. So the Museum of Modern Art in New York, in Berlin, this is the exhibit. So the exhibit of the Museum of Modern Art in Berlin is exhibited as American invention. It consists of European artifacts, refers to Europeans, but it is an American, that's why it is within a Museum of American Art. And it as you can see, this is a painting of the cover of the catalog, Cubism and Abstract Art. And you enter, this is Cézanne, and then you can go to the right to Matisse and Fauves, and then to the to Matisse, yeah, you get and go to Fauves until non-geometric abstraction Kandinsky, or you go to the other side to Picasso, Cubist, and to geometrical abstraction. The last, the fourth wall, which closes the end of the museum, is based on this exhibition, Dada, which also took place in 1936, a historization of the immediate movements of the late 20s and 30s, fantastic art, Dada and surrealism, that took place also at MoMA. So the narrative of this museum ends around 1930s. That's the storyline. So the museum has a closed narrative. Doesn't go beyond this one. On the walls of the are now the exhibitions of the American modern art that was shown in Europe after the Second World War through the international program of the Museum of Modern Art. And there were these are German catalogs, so they are paintings of the catalogs. This is not a painting, this is a reproduction, as you can see from the Strand. 12 American painters and contemporary painters and sculptors, and modern art in the USA. So these are now the paintings of the pages of the catalog and of these two catalogs. The second exhibition was one that really brought most of the half of the exhibits were from belong to the abstract expressionism. On the other wall are two later exhibitions. One was the New American Painting here, also the pages from the catalog, and Documenta 2, 1959, when Americans were brought as a group by the International MoMA International Program. So these are the catalogs. So what you see are the paintings here. And then some of the paintings from this, the New American Painting, were then appear in the another room. Okay, so this is another exhibit. This is the New American Painting Klein room, Franz Klein. And these are now paintings made after the paintings that were in the catalog of the New American Painting. And this is the permanent exhibit of the Museum of American Art in Berlin. Gottlieb, Newman, Klein, Rothko, Motherwell. Some of the paintings of the covers of the MoMA catalogs. And there is a small room that relates to the history of the 20th century modern, history of MoMA, pardon me. This is a group of young curators visiting the museum. Also, occasionally at the museum, some professor will have lectures on contemporary art and various themes, as we, Astrid Schmidt-Burkhardt, having a lecture with her students. And there are some events occasionally taken as well. Presentation of certain projects doesn't have to be, they don't have to be related to the story of the Museum of American Art. So this is a permanent exhibition of the Museum of American Art that is in Berlin since 2004. In addition to this permanent, there were several collections of the Museum of American Art that were shown on the temporary exhibitions, like this one that has a theme, a subject matter, the exhibition of the Museum of Modern Art that traveled from 1955 until 1956 through many European capitals. Here it is titled 50 Years of Art from United States, and also, as you can see, includes various categories, not only painting and sculpture and prints, but also film, photography, typography, and so forth. To understand the context in which this exhibition appeared, take a look of this 1954, just a year before published the Musée National d'Art Moderne, the Museum of Modern Art in Paris catalog guide. And on the, as you can see, on the floor plan, we can recognize many of these movements and names, individuals from the 20th century modern art. And it somehow looks kind of a normal, nothing unusual, until we get to the third floor. And in this, on the third floor, there is this tiny room, has number 31, the last room. And then you understand that this, what you are looking at, is in fact the French art, and the rest of the world is in this tiny room. If you think of what I said about the Museum of Modern Art, Museum of Modern Art was a cause étrangère from the American perspective, nothing else. So the entire MoMA until the Second World War was just room 31 from the American perspective. So it's complete inversion of the... to understand that at that point, Museum of Modern Art in Paris, or Paris, was still the center of modernity, even for Americans. So if there was no MoMA, this would be the alternative. And this was the alternative that comes out of 19th century, as we have seen from the exhibition of, that were based on national schools. Also, at this, in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art in Paris, you won't, under M, you won't find Mondrian, as we noticed already. You won't find Malevich. You won't find Magritte, who is now as an individual. So Magritte was not at this point still at the collection of the museum. Marcel Duchamp, who Kurt Schwitters. Some of the key artists of the that were in the Alfred Barr story are not in this story, and you have hundreds of completely unknown people in this in the collection. I mean, not unknown from our perspective. So this is what were the options. The third option at that time was the Soviet option. So there were three options on the table. One was the socialistic realism, another was this national schools concept, and internationalism that was promoted by MoMA. So the exhibition came, you know, maybe symbolically or maybe not, on the, this SS America to France of American art. And even we have here to just underline this idea of internationalism by from that was coming from MoMA, that the sculpture by Gaston Lachasse, who was a French-born, he lived in, grew up in France and came to New York, and now he was being exhibited to France as an American. So these are some of the views of this exhibition. It was important that this exhibition was from the MoMA collection. So this is the MoMA collection. And it had an impact on some museum, European museums start thinking to finally acquire the, beginning to acquire American art. Until this point, European museums were not buying American art.
What date is that?
55. And of course, paintings by Pollock were had a huge interest. And this is one of the comments of the critics. So, but it is a question. It was not a question for the only Parisian critic, but it was a question for Americans. Even in 1939, these are some of the flyers that relates to the exhibit. So this was the Museum of American Art now at Lyon. So this exhibit about the about this exhibition that took place in Paris was shown at the 2007 Lyon Biennial, and we have the now in addition to the catalogs and publications for, related to the American exhibitions in Europe, the paintings of the pages of the catalog, paintings of the opening, and paintings from the film footage. Like here, this was the film. So these are stills from the film that were painted. And also, we have a small gallery of abstract expressionists here, and the paintings are from the catalog. So that's why they're black and white. And this is a Ministry of Culture of France at the exhibit, almost 50 years after another Minister of Culture was visiting the American show in 1955. So these are two Ministry of Cultures. And this exhibition then traveled to Amsterdam and to London. Let me see the views. And also interesting article related to this exhibition. First paragraph recognizes the same thing that was understood in France, but has a different resonance here. So that this is how American art was seen in Europe. And then the exhibition went to Frankfurt, and then Vienna. The Vienna was the last stop of the exhibition. However, some of the some of people that were from USIS in the American embassy in Belgrade, since Belgrade was not far from Vienna, came to then Yugoslavian government and offered them to bring the exhibition to Belgrade, which was completely out of schedule. And the first response by a lower, this is a report of the meeting, but then the first comment of this was, I don't know if I have it in large, yes. We cannot have this exhibition organized on such short notice. In any case, this will be some kind of American tutti-frutti. And that's how the exhibition was dismissed. However, then the USIS sent the official letter to the director of the program of the foreign exchange, and his comment was, "I am absolutely for." So the exhibition was on, and the person that signed this was Marko Ristić, who was known as a surrealist writer, friend of Breton, lived in Paris, and we can find in this 1926 almanac he appears with his poem. So that was the person who was in charge of this committee, and he decided that the exhibition should take place, and we have now in July 1956, the exhibition opened in Belgrade, the only socialist country that ever MoMA at the time had any exhibition. And there are for some of these showings of MoMA, this exhibition, there are no press releases. There are two press releases for this exhibition. Apparently, it was very important to MoMA as well. So this is about the Porter McRae arriving to Belgrade. Porter McRae didn't arrive on Lufthansa, but he arrived on Orient Express from Venice because he was at the Venice Biennale that opened just beginning of June. So he took Orient Express and arrived in Belgrade. And the exhibition took place in this pavilion, the painting part. We see the opening. This is Marko Ristić, Porter McRae and American ambassador. And you can see some of the works that were being exhibited. This exhibition had, throughout Yugoslavia, had a coverage, but it was very quickly forgotten, completely. There were other exhibitions that were remembered, like Picasso exhibition, Henry Moore exhibition, but this exhibition completely disappeared from memory until Museum of American Art brought it back. And this was the, I would say, the theme of this exhibition. This exhibition was the theme of the Museum of American exhibit at the Istanbul Biennale. And you can see it's titled American Tutti Frutti. So very similar structure, the one that was at Lyon, because it's the same exhibition, just based on a different material, different catalogs. Yeah, that's the Dorothy Miller Gallery. And in 2005, at the Venice Biennale, the theme of the Museum of American Art exhibit was called the American 64. It was about the appearance of the Americans at the 1964 Venice Biennale, when Rauschenberger received the grand prize. It was organized by the Jewish Museum, and Alan Solomon was the curator. Some of the works were shipped by U.S. Air Force, as you can see it being unloaded. And here too, this is from the plane photo. And this is the American Pavilion. In the American Pavilion at Giardini, there were shown only large paintings by Maurice Lewis and Kenneth Noland. There was no room for the others. So the others were shown in the space outside of Giardini, which created some then problems. You will see later when the award was announced. They were shown in the American consulate. But since it started, so these were the paintings that were shown at the Giardini. And this is the these are the views of the rest of the American participants at the consulate. And it became now at some point apparent that the Rauschenberg might get a grand prize, so the but in order to him to be eligible, the works has to be shown in Giardini, not in outside. So the works were brought in various ways, as you can see here, on the apparatus here. And there was no room in to show them in inside the pavilion. They were exhibited outside. They built the panels and they exhibited outside. So, but nevertheless, the it was formally at the in at the Giardini. So, and this was the painting for which Rauschenberg received the award. We see him next to Alan Solomon and receiving the award. And these were the special the French reactions to this award, this event. So the America proclaims the end of the School of Paris and lunch in order to colonize pop art, in order to colonize Europe. And also this is from Life magazine, like the subtitle, Europe Explodes, American Takes Prize. And it is after this exhibition, all these events, that Clement Greenberg was, how to say, confident enough to write this kind of a title. It was 1965. In Europe, it was by mid-50s understood that there is a change coming from the United States, that the balance of whatever was called power was shifted toward New York from Paris, but for someone like Greenberg to this was like completely an old news. But that was how it reflects the timidness on the American side all the way, and still looking to Paris as kind of a center of modernity. And this exhibit was now the theme of this. This exhibition was the theme of this exhibit at the, of the American Art Museum of American Art. The paintings are painted as the way they are in the catalog reproduced. So the three flags are black and white in the catalog. They're black and white here. And you can see some of the images I've shown you are here appear as the paintings. In 2011, at the CUNY Graduate Center, Museum of American Art helped organizing this exhibition called titled The Making of Americans, titled after well-known Gertrude Stein book. And it is a story that now I like to, I'd say, concentrate a little bit. As I've shown you and mentioned in some places, this different understanding or perception of what is modern art in on both sides of the Atlantic. It seems that it was that MoMA made its narrative based on these avant-garde movements that were not the way that were perceived in Europe, But that was possible because there were a series of collections that preceded Museum Modern Art, starting with Gertrude Stein collection, through Cohn Sisters collection, the Stieglitz exhibiting Picasso and Matisse in New York 1910, Armory Show, Arensberg collection, Société Anonyme, Gallatin collection. All these collections of American art, of American collections of European modern art, were avant-garde oriented. They were skewed from what was the normal European art scene. And these collections gave the foundation for MoMA to have, when MoMA appeared with the story of 20th century modern art, that was avant-garde oriented, it didn't look strange. This is how Americans saw European art, and they saw it through these series of American collections. And these American collections were different from, there are no parallels in Europe of these kind of a collections that were assembled of European modern art here. It started with the Gertrude and Leo Stein collection in 1904, 1905, where for the first time at one place you could see paintings by Picasso, Matisse, and Cézanne hang together. This happened in this collection. And 30 years later, when MoMA unfolded as a show, the story of 20th century modern art, it started with Cézanne, and you could go to Matisse and Picasso in two directions. So this was a kind of a collection anticipated in a way the story of 20th century modern art would go, but it also played a role in this. It's not just coincidental. Namely, Alfred Stieglitz comes to 1908 to Paris, and he visits Stein's, and guess what? He was the first to exhibit Picasso and Matisse in New York before Armory Show, 1910. So he saw this, he recognized, he brought these artists to New York. And then we have the Armory Show, and the out of Armory Show, many collections, including the Arensberg collection emerged. The Arensberg were very much influenced, obviously, also by Duchamp. And also another result of the Armory Show was the Société Anonyme, in which organized by Duchamp and Catherine Dreyer. And you can notice that in this first annual report, the subtitle is Museum Modern Art. And there was some kind of almost a dispute between MoMA when they... So that's why MoMA was named the Museum of Modern Art, because to separate them from Museum of Modern Art. And so that was the one of the collections that was also avant-garde oriented, as we can see on this exhibition at the Brooklyn Museum, titled exactly as the Armory Show, International Exhibition of Modern Art, 1926. Large glass is not broken yet there. But you see Mondrian's, and I would say if this exhibition would be today, it wouldn't look anachronistic. Some MoMA exhibition look even more anachronistic today than this one. And then you have this Gallery of Living Art or Gallatin collection that was also, as you can see, very abstract oriented. It also had in the catalog you find the studios, artists in their studios, and this Leger painting was at NYU. This museum collection was exhibited for a long time NYU, and then transferred to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Hila Ribe was a major force behind the Guggenheim collection. And this was, as you can see, it was called the non-objective paintings, so it's again the avant-garde oriented. And then comes a Museum of Modern Art that was initiated by Mary Quinn Sullivan, Abby Rockefeller, and Lily Bliss. Lily Bliss also began collecting at the Armory Show, so that was another effect of the Armory Show, indirect on MoMA. And this is her room, and you can see some of the Cezannes, including the Bader, were first in her collection, and then she gave the collection to... Actually, the collection was passed to the MoMA after her death, 1931. And then we have the first exhibition of the Museum of Modern Art with the lone exhibitions, as you can see, of these post-impressionists. And comparing to the Société Anonyme exhibition 3 years earlier, this was a very conservative exhibition, if you can see it, even by hanging. But that was the beginning. The immediately after that was the painting by 19 Living Americans. And then there was still the question, even in the, as I mentioned, regarding the European reception. There were critics who would say, for example, that when MoMA in 19, and this was published apropos, this is Edward Alden Jewell was the chief critic of the New York Times at the time. And he analyzed the French press apropos first American exhibition of American art organized by MoMA in Paris at Jeu de Paume in 1938. And he came to the same question as the French had, because they said, when we go to where this, what is American art? Where this American art came from? When we go to American museums, we see Italian Renaissance, we see Dutch Golden Age, we see French Impressionists, and even we go to MoMA, we just see Europeans. There are no Americans. So what is American art? And that was one of the questions that was even obviously that appeared in America as well. And this this book was the result. So there was serious, since MoMA was organizing the kind of a main interest of MoMA was European modern art, but they had to have American art. So the American art was from time to time being exhibited by these strange titles and numbers, like this 19 Living Americans. And there are a lot of these very neutral, in a way, titles. It doesn't say anything. While you have, this is enough. I went another direction. Anyway, so as a result of this feeling of almost inferiority complex, Dorothy Miller was apparently assigned to organize a series of exhibitions of American art, so to show that there is attention, that MoMA is paying attention to American art. That and MoMA was accused by being completely indifferent to American art by many critics in New York. So in order to respond, there were a series of exhibitions, like this is 1946, 14 Americans, then we have 15 Americans, 1952, we have 12 Americans. But just to give put in the context, this happened in the, it doesn't look this way as I'm presenting here. One was 1946, another was 1952, and another was 1956. So it's a huge, there are many exhibitions took place between these two, these exhibitions. What is important about these exhibitions, I didn't have here images. These exhibitions were very strange combinations, but in each of them you will find three or four abstract expressionists among the others. But at that time, still in the United States, it was a practice to exhibit. When you have a group show, you have one work per artist. So you have like what is the term for this? Like a conventional group show. So each artist was always like a Whitney Biennials. There are even in the 60s, the catalogs of Whitney Biennale, you see that each artist of the Whitney Biennale is represented by one work. At the Dorothy Miller exhibition, you find entire walls belong to each artist. So you get a different understanding, different sense of this, of the work of a certain person. That was a change. So out of, as you can see, this is Clifford Steele and this is Dorothy Miller in front of us. So you can see like three, there are more than this, the three of Clifford Steele in one room. That was unusual at that time. Or Pollock, like, and this is 1952, exhibition 15 Americans. And out of this series of exhibitions were extracted this group which we call today the Abstract Expressionist, as we can see them here on this kind of iconic photo. And in 1958, after this exhibition of 1956, the interest of European museums was to show, apparently was to show Abstract Expressionists. And this is an announcement of the, that was the, at the New York Times. And we can see here Nelson Rockefeller, who was a member of the board, Alfred Barr, Dorothy Miller, and Porter McRae. But look at the title. Title 1958. The title shows the, still this sense of timidness toward Europeans. It says the young brother is preparing to show its cultural achievements to the older brother, basically. So this is in Basel, at the opening of the exhibition. Then the exhibition went to Berlin. And this is, again, this what Dorothy Miller did was to show each of the works of the artists with many works, not with one work. While in Europe, this was already understood, so it's completely different reception. In Europe, it is Horizon magazine, European, in London. It says the new American painting captures Europe. So two very different receptions of both sides of the ocean. And this is the exhibition. This was the first of these circulating exhibitions that was then shown at the MoMA at the end of travel, as we can see it here, and it shows all the cities that he traveled through. And this was considered to be the landmark, but if I would say it will be, for me, it was 1956 exhibition that was more important than this one. And we see the Dorothy Miller surrounded by some of the artists that were from the New American Painting Show. And this is how this process of being completely in the margin of what is what was considered to be the kind of the main art scene, American art, through collecting and interpreting European art, came to this point that became kind of a leading art scene after the Second World War. And the role that collections of American or European art by Americans, the specific collections based on the avant-garde art, played a role. So this was the theme of the exhibit at the CUNY Graduate Center 2011. The exhibition was titled The Making of Americans, and you can see from here Gertrude Stein, Stiglitz, Catherine Dreyer, Marcel Duchamp, Dorothy Miller, Alfred Barr, Hilary Ebay, and you enter the gallery. Then to the left is the, it says, yeah, that's on the right, is the title. And this is the important thing for the kind of a position that in many ways even the Museum of American Art accepts. The Museum of American Art doesn't think it's an art museum. It is about art museum, but not an art museum, and this is kind of a briefly, you find more about this attitude that is represented here by Benjamin in the book. He elaborates this concept. So the exhibition starts with a Gertrude Stein, the Salon de Fleurus, which is in New York-based permanent exhibit since 1992. here was presented outside of its space. Then we have a Museum of Modern Art in front of us. But on the left, before that, we have this journey from the Salon of Gertrude Stein to Stieglitz to Armory Show and Duchamp's an iconic Armory Show painting. And then Société Anonyme, Gallatin Collection at NYU, and Hilla Ribe in Guggenheim Collection. So this was the exhibit, and you can see there some of the artifacts that were, or catalogs that were also depicted as paintings here, appeared in the, like these two, appeared in the vitrine here, this and this. And we have paintings over there. So this is like kind of a pre-war situation with the MoMA being completely European. Two, emergence of the post-war art scene through these exhibitions. So this is a wall, you can see this, one of the walls of the Museum of Modern Art here, which is 2x2. This is called Museum of Modern Art because this is a really museum. Doesn't matter that the paintings are so small in a sense. When you have a copy, it's not original, it doesn't matter where the size is irrelevant. It becomes a symbol, so... As on the cover of this book, Benjamin says, a copy is a meta-original, so it's beyond or almost antithesis of the original. But I cannot go there. So this is the Museum of Modern Art. That is 2x2 meter. It is not much different from this, only the size. This is 1:1, and it is MoMA made in China. It was part of it's in Guangzhou, 2011, at the Times Museum, at what is completely on the periphery of Guangzhou. There was an exhibition, a museum that is not, and Museum of American Art was presented by this Museum of Modern Art, that covers the narrative of the Alfred Barr diagram. So these are now 1:1 copies.
Made in China by
Chinese. Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't use the term artist. We don't use the term artist even for what we do, so they will be painters. And there are some small changes, as you can see. This is not ready-made, this is a sculpture. And so we have this MoMA books. It's interesting also that not only the Duchamp was assigned 1817, but the diagram also, you'll see it in another image. So this is the Museum of American Art logo. And that evening, the opening was the lecture, announcement of the lecture by Walter Benjamin. The lecture was, I think, reprinted in this book, The Unmaking of Art, and we see young Benjamin presenting his lecture. The same lecture was repeated, but this time in English, not in Chinese, in at Arnolfine, and we see now Benjamin again. Looks a bit different. And this is now the cover, and you can see the modern, everything was dated 100 years before, was then on the MoMA catalog, as if modern art appeared first in China and then came to here. And out of this came another exhibition, which included a three-part exhibition. It had a Gertrude Stein and the Americans, but I won't show that part. I just want to connect with this MoMA story. As you can see here, it's a French translation, and it's 100 years in the future, as if modern art is yet to come to France. So these are also works produced in Paris, in Strasbourg and Saint-Étienne. Two academies did these paintings. So this is MoMA made in France. So beyond that is the 50 years of American art shows. But this is, as you see, this is 2017. It's also, again, a sculpture. So that's the selection of the exhibits of the Museum of American Art. So you can understand there, some of them were analyzed in articles and interviews by Walter Benjamin in the book. So... if you now have questions or comments or anything you want to say, please, you know, you're welcome. Yes, please.
I think it's so interesting that your museum has, reproduced the paintings as they appear in the catalogs, so in black and white. And I was wondering what you think the effect that had on the European audiences. Did most of the people see the paintings themselves in person, and therefore the catalog just kind of reminded them of it? Or do you think the catalog was the source that a lot of artists were looking at, and therefore not being able to see the colors of these artworks?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about this, conversion from, let's say, color into black and white. It is, this is all very, for example, if you look this painting on to the right, this Man Ray painting, it's very well known. If it was on the black and white, people will know to which painting it refers to. We are here operating with a familiar landscape. There is necessary, you have to have some education. If you don't know anything about modern art, if you go to the MoMA, you wouldn't, you would just see colored surfaces. Today, it doesn't, it wouldn't mean anything to you. So you have to be, in fact, indoctrinated to a certain degree. That's indoctrination happens in education. You read books, you take classes, and you understand who are the icons. So, what are the icons? Like Demoiselles d'Avignon, so you go in the MoMA and you recognize it immediately in front of you. So that's it. So how you can interpret this conversion depends on who is the observer. You just keep, in this, obviously there is a certain principle here. If a catalog is used as a source, as a primary source, then out of whatever is out of catalog, you use it the way it is in the catalog. Let's say whoever painted doesn't have to know how the original looks like. But there is always a way today, especially, that you can check. You can find on the internet, you can find at the museums, whatever the original. So what is interesting, there is an interview in the book, I think it's titled, my dear, this is not what it seems to be. And apparently it was at at the Venice Biennale when a person was looking into these kind of like paintings that are all kind of a masterpieces and realized they cannot be, that all these paintings cannot be brought together just like that. So he turned to his wife and he said, my dear, this is not what it seems to be. In a way, this could be kind of a motto of the Museum of American Art. This is not what it's. This is not Museum of Modern. This is not art museum. This is about art museum. One interesting discussion that, for example, Benjamin noticed already is that I like is a question. You know, let's say this man raised in a kind of abstract painting, and we know what is abstract painting, and we know it was kind of a kind of opposition to something, what is a representational painting or realistic painting. But what is a copy of an abstract painting? In what category belongs to? Is it abstract painting? Or it's perhaps a realistic painting? Because this obviously, the copy is obviously depicting already existing object. So it looks abstract, but if you know, if you don't know, it's abstract. But if you know, then you have this dilemma. What is this? And this is why this the expression of this confused guy who said, my dear, this is not what it seems to be, is exactly makes a point. He understood that this is not what it seems to be. So this is just an example how a copy is not a very simple kind of a repetition. It also transforms, even if it doesn't look different. It is something very different. And this is something that was apparently neglected, not understood, especially in the world that is based on the uniqueness of the original and the author, which is not old. It's 200 years old. It's not older than that. It started to emerge this vaguely through at mid 18th century in France, but the idea of originality is 200 years. And uniqueness, originality, authenticity. I mean, you can find early Mengs in early late 18th century talking about Paolo Belvedere, if it is original or not. So that was beginning. But the way we have it today, and this is on these are the notions which art scene is based today. The idea of this is what Museum of American Art doesn't have. Museum of American Art doesn't have originals and doesn't have authors. Thus, because the reason why there are no authors is because there are no originals. And also another interesting thing that you probably didn't notice is that if you would see like any show today in New York and you try to repeat it, not only that you will have legal problems, but also conceptual problems. But if you, let's say, go to Museum of American Art and take pictures and then you make the same thing somewhere else, there is no one going to go after you. It's because you will make something that is out of its public domain. Not that the museum is public domain, but everything that is at the museum is a public domain. So you can just simply take it and make yourself. And you will not that what you are going to have is not going to be less than this, what is it in Berlin. It will probably even reinforce the point or the concept of the Berlin exhibit. So it shows that this is something else. It's not exactly what the contemporary art scene functions or the concepts, the ideas on which this contemporary art scene is based, which is uniqueness of the author and the original. And also the another thing is, which is here, not implicitly but explicitly, question is the chronology. Chronology is a key backbone of the historical narrative. Here we obviously see the things that are even dated, as you see. This is 2017. This year doesn't exist except on some futuristic calendar. But it's here. It's a physical object. It's, in a way, it's real. So how, what we do with it, how we treat this, and these are not really, there are no algorithms for this kind of a landscape. You don't know how to behave. And the reason, for example, I am a technical assistant here without name, although there are people that know me personally, it's like this is one way of how you can maybe do things in the public in a underlying certain roles. Like you have in a film or in a theater, you have someone playing a butler or a doctor or a policeman, has no name, it just plays its role. So why not being a technical assistant with no name? It is what you do, and I, most of the time, and I am, and that's how I became technical assistant, I hang these exhibitions. So I do technical thing. Please.
It seems as though you end in the late 50s, maybe with or maybe very early 60s. Is there a reason for that? Do you not go to pop, which has its own American history?
Yeah. We, the last, following this chronological concept, we did have an exhibition in London of Seth Ziegelab. It was Seth Ziegelab, author, and the name of the exhibition was The Exhibitions. That was the name. It was an exhibition of paintings of the covers of the Ziegelab's catalogs. So all this conceptual Xerox book, June, July, whatever, Wiener's book, they were all painted, and they were exhibited as paintings, which is kind of also similar like this Duchamp's, it is an antithesis of conceptual, but there was, so that was like the last kind of historical developments, if we use that term, was the, because these are really the Ziegelab apparently was the in a way perhaps more interesting as a curator, although he never, I don't think he perceived himself as a curator. I don't know much, so I may be making a mistake, but some of his exhibitions were stretching the notion of what exhibition is. So, and that was not the case with, let's say, the person who is much more popular, which is Harald Zeman. So there was, that was the last historical period that we covered. Okay, please.
So what in your opinion changed in his interests, perhaps in the world around him, not in his interests?
This is, of course, very difficult for me for various reasons to answer, because I'm not an expert in Benjamin. So I won't be able to answer. I'm a technical person. Benjamin is a theoretician, and he writes theoretical. So what he chooses to write about is, I guess, it's his or hers, because there were a couple of Benjamins that were female that appeared. So I won't be, the only thing I can say, the way the reappearance of Benjamin could be interpreted is that is a consequence, I guess, of the notion that history is just a story. It's not the story, but a story. So, and once these people who are, even the anyone who appears as a character in the story is not only exists as a human being once, but also becomes a character in the story. So there are different, and there are different ways to interpret certain characters. So there are different takes on a different historical person. Once we have understand that history is a story, then there will be possibility to have not only one Benjamin, maybe a second Benjamin, maybe a third Benjamin. You know, like it's there is a possibility with unforeseeable consequences that might even create certain kind of a chaos. I have no idea if it's good or not good. I don't have this. This is something that is uncharted territory. So the rules are made as you go. Who knows? This year appeared one, but maybe next book fair there'll be five Benjamins, with five different books, or five somebody else. So once we have historical characters becoming just characters, then they can be played again by a different somebody else. But then somehow the entire concept, because in his lecture I watched on Mondrian, he never questioned himself. He's talking about the Mondrian as a strange thing, but he is also a strange thing at the same time, because he is the also kind of a duplicate, in addition to discussing that these Mondrians are duplicates or they're copies. He is a copy too. He, in the second lecture, at some point, just brings up this issue of himself as a character. But this is one way of seeing it. Maybe Benjamin would be following that line that was closer to what was the, let's say, earliest version of Benjamin. Maybe. But somehow the notion of the concept of the question of originality and the copy and authenticity somehow is not so far from Benjamin. He just found probably that there are some kind of a rich territory there, something that was not uncharted yet, that he can, like he was one who mentioned this distinction between abstract and the realist copy of an abstract painting that he noticed. We'll see. Yes, please. I don't The you can you have to have a reference in order to have a reference to, like to have to kind of a referential points. For example, you wouldn't have a copy without the original. So you have to have a original in order to have a copy. Otherwise, it's not possible. So you have to have a historical narrative in order to try to establish something that might become a meta-narrative, meta-historical narrative, a meta-history. Without history, you won't have meta-history. So that's why the referring to well-known phenomena that shaped the way that our world looks today in, let's say, in art context, like a place like MoMA, and how the MoMA established the narrative that we are a canon in which we are today, still the entire art scene is more or less on the, within that canon, then you have to have that with that will then try to find a way beyond that narrative. So the way out is not to forget that, but to simply recontextualize it. That what will Benjamin say. So this is what? Why you need these, otherwise there will be completely separate worlds. The way as Benjamin, his, I think, second lecture would use the relationship between the historical narrative and a Christian narrative, where a Christian story, once being a kind of a universal, then was by historical narrative gradually recontextualized and turned into one chapter, which we call Middle Ages. But what the historical narrative did, it didn't forget the Christian narrative. It just turned it into a chapter of its. But the point was that this meta-narrative not only doesn't forget the, let me now think to be precise, because I have to learn these things. This not only that historical narrative cannot only forget or recontextualize, but it has to be completely different, meaning that the constitutive notions of a meta-narrative cannot be constitutive notions of the narrative. Otherwise, it will be the same story. I don't know if that makes sense. So if order something to be meta, it's not enough that you are outside and you're referring to what is you are outside to, but that outside has to be, in a way, antithesis of what you're looking at. Like a copy is antithesis of the original in many ways. And yet you still the original, you see original on copy. You don't see anything else. You see copy of the, you see the original. When you see copy of Mondrian, it's still Mondrian. When you look this, you still see here Dishan and Mandray. So that is the kind of a very strange paradox. And I don't know what are the consequences of that, honestly. Please. Yeah, of course, but you know, it's you know, there are how many of you here? Somebody might write that book. You know, it's a you know, maybe you know, one day we'll read that book. You know, so there is no limits here in a sense. This is not charted territory. So that's possible. I can see, in his interview. For the Chinese newspaper, I think he was asked about his relation to Alfred Barr, who is also associate of the Museum of American Art. But he gives completely different lectures on, doesn't give lectures like Benjamin. And he said that he never met him during the 30s and and 40s, but then he now cooperates very well with Alfred Barr. So these kind of things are possible. Yeah, it's. I think he became gradually associated because he started understanding that this is a good case study for his theory. So, he can write, there are some properties of the Museum of American Art, but he is not limited to the museum, as you can see from the. It's not like only about the Museum of American Art. There are informed. Yeah, there are informed assistants as well.